Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, April is Stress Awareness Month. We'll learn what to do when stress becomes a health concern, simple steps you can take to keep it in check. New York could lose up to 14% of its workforce under proposed mass deportation policies. A new report from the Rockefeller Institute of Government breaks down what that could mean for the state's economy, tax base, and communities. We'll hear from the report's author ahead. Plus, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. And we'll speak with Lori Ramey of the Upper Delaware Council about this year's litter sweep. Plus, it's our spring fun drive. We're 69% of our goal. Donate now to get us across the finish line. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. military says it will start enforcing a naval blockade of the Strait of Hormuz this hour. It's an effort to put additional pressure on Iran. As NPR's Greg Myrie reports, President Trump announced the blockade yesterday after U.S.-Iran peace talks over the weekend failed to produce a breakthrough.
The U.S. Navy has a substantial presence in the region, and President Trump says it won't take long for the U.S. to, quote, clean out the strait. Still, the blockade comes with risks. Iran is believed to have placed mines in the waterway. Also, Iran says that if any of its ports are attacked, it will respond by attacking ports belonging to Arab Gulf countries. Iran has effectively closed the waterway for the past several weeks, aside from a small number of friendly or neutral commercial ships it allows through. It's not clear if any of those ships will attempt to challenge the U.S. blockade. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron says France and Britain are organizing a conference to help find ways to restore navigation through the strait. Writing online, Macron says he's calling for a peaceful multinational mission that is not a part of the warring parties. He says it should be set up as soon as circumstances allow. Stocks opened mixed this morning as crude oil prices jumped back above $100 a barrel. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 230 points in early trading.
The failure of negotiators to secure the opening of the Strait of Hormuz sent oil prices climbing again. Gasoline prices have shown little movement in recent days. AAA says the average price of gas is now $4.12 a gallon. It was less than $3 a gallon before the U.S. launched its war against Iran. The U.S. housing market remains in a slump. According to the National Association of Realtors, sales of existing homes fell 3.6% last month. For homes that did sell in March, the average sales price was just under $409,000. Freddie Mac says mortgage rates, which briefly dipped below 6% this spring, are now averaging 6.37%. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Some Democrats are urging California Congressman Eric Swalwell to resign his congressional seat. He has already suspended his campaign for California governor. News reports came to light last week alleging that Swalwell engaged in sexual assault and sexual misconduct against some women, including former staff members. From member station KQED, Guy Marzorati says Swalwell rejected the accusations.
Swalwell released a video on Friday night denying that he ever committed sexual assault. But I think it's worth noting that video did not explicitly deny sexual relationships. It did not explicitly deny inappropriate behavior with staff members.
Guy Marzorati reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. A federal judge has dismissed President Trump's defamation case against the Wall Street Journal. Trump had sued the news outlet for publishing a letter Trump allegedly wrote to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The letter was framed by the outline of a woman's body and contained text and Trump's apparent signature. Trump has denied writing the letter, but the federal judge says Trump's accusation does not show the news outlet acted with actual malice. A federal appeals court says President Trump's White House ballroom project can move forward for now. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the Trump administration challenged a lower federal court ruling that said the project has to get approval from Congress.
A 3-judge panel for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit ruled 2-1 to allow construction to proceed through next Friday, while the district court further reviews the case. The National Trust for Historic Preservation sued to stop construction last December. It argued the president lacked the statutory authority to undertake the project. In March, a district court judge granted a preliminary injunction to halt construction, even though the project was greenlit by the National Capital Planning Commission and the Commission on Fine Arts. Also, the East Wing had already been demolished. In a statement to NPR, National Trust President and CEO Carol Quillen expressed appreciation for the Court of Appeals' swift actions. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The WNBA holds its annual draft tonight. Some draft stars will include UCLA center Lauren Betts and TCU guard Olivia Miles. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Our spring fund drive is still going, and we need your help to close it out. We're 69% of our goal as of this morning, and we could use your help to get to the end. 845-482-4141 is where you can donate by giving us a call. Say hi to Kim or Ronald or whoever might be in the office there. I think I saw those two. And then you can also go to wjffradio.org and donate as well. Normally, I'd be really stressed during this time because it's our spring fund drive, but given the fact that we're going so well, I'm not as stressed, but April is Stress Awareness Month, and if you're feeling overwhelmed, you're not alone. From work pressures to financial concerns and the constant stream of news and information, stress is something many of us deal with every day. But when does everyday stress become something more serious, and what can we actually do about it? Joining us now is Dr. Nicholas Batson with Crystal Run Healthcare, here to talk about how stress affects our bodies and minds and some practical ways to manage it. Dr. Batson, thanks for being here.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, we kind of use this term stressed loosely, I guess. We all say that, I guess. But medically speaking, what is stress and how does it affect the body?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we all have normal stress, right? The normal physical stress, let's say you're going to train for a marathon, that's going to be a little stressful on your body, or you got to get your bills paid. But then, you know, when it becomes an issue, it's that chronic stress where it starts to affect your health, your overall well-being. And some of the big risk factors that you see that start to go up with that chronic stress, which is, you know, some people define it as every day or multiple days out of the week where it goes on for weeks and months at a time. That's oftentimes kind of how we look at chronic stress.
And let's drill down into that a little bit more, the differences between everyday stress and chronic stress. Why does that distinction matter, and what are some of the more common stressors?
The distinction matters because it starts to mess with your physical health. I say mess kind of in a loose term because there's some big things that really happen with chronic stress. You have increase in heart disease, so heart attacks and arrhythmias of the heart. You have increase in blood pressure, and blood pressure, those increases oftentimes hard to notice because you don't actually feel them until they get to be very high at actual stroke levels. So you could have a stroke from that chronic stress. The day-to-day stress is like, I don't know, you think of it like you wake up and like you spill your milk and you're like, oh man, that's not going to be a good thing. I got to clean it up. Versus like chronic stress, the way your brain thinks about it is, oh my gosh, like I spilled the milk, the glass is broken and it was already spoiled for a week. And so it's just amplified kind of throughout the day that you carry it and have it in your body and in your brain.
Is all stress bad, or is some stress actually kind of helpful?
No, some stress is actually kind of helpful. You know, there's this term called resilience about what we do when we get overwhelmed and what we get stressed and the coping strategies that we use. It's a little bit like a muscle. You know, you kind of got to exercise a little bit. You do have to push yourself. And we all know our limits, right? We all have our threshold. I was watching a documentary the other day about the people that run ultra marathons, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's no way I'd run 200 miles in the desert and it'd be 115 degrees outside. And I'm like, that's a much different level of chronic stress that they put on their body. But anybody, and the idea was anybody can build up to that. And so we all can handle a certain amount of stress. We all have our threshold, and when we get more stressed, our tolerance for our stress threshold, how we use our coping strategies, actually starts to go down the more stress that we get. And so we actually have to have some coping strategies to be able to manage that stress better.
You mentioned some of the warning signs, some of the physical warning signs like high blood pressure, fatigue. Are there some mental warning signs that folks should maybe be aware of that stress is becoming harmful to their health?
Yeah, the term like negative Nancy, right, where it's like everything seems awful and insurmountable, and your brain just, another fancy term that we use is rumination. So it's like a hamster wheel. You just keep thinking about things over and over again. You can't get it off of your brain. You can't find a problem, or you can't find a solution for a problem that you may perceive that you have that may not actually be a problem. Your brain kind of gets stuck. You feel like kind of mushy, kind of like you're going through that. You know, we get all our that nice, you know, snow that we get up here. It's like trudging through 24 inches of snow when it's cold, and your body just feels like you can't move. And your brain does the same thing during times of stress. Just feels like it's not there. You kind of, you're off. A lot of people just say, like, I just feel like I'm kind of off all the time. But there are other physical things. I mean, you know, we talk about stress headaches, or the term that we use is tension headaches. So you get this, the muscles in the back of your neck start to pull on the muscles on your scalp and on your skull, and it causes these very specific kind of headaches. That are in the back. They feel like tension headaches. It's like a vice on your head. Some people have these palpitations where your heart feels like it's beating too fast. You know, the brain and the body are not disconnected. And oftentimes, for the majority of us, our stress is often noticed as physical things before it's actual mental things. Some people get those stomach aches, that weird stomachy feeling, you know, can't go to the bathroom the right way. And we have that both mental part of it and the physical part of it.
Yeah, and when you gave that example about the spilt milk, the person who's highly stressed, I kind of thought of that as someone who may be catastrophizing the situation and that mental side of things when it comes to stress.
Yeah, no, great word to use. You sound like you're a therapist right now already talking to people.
I have a lot of experience, doctor.
Yeah, no, catastrophizing. I mean, the other word that we use is magnification, right? You see something and it just seems so much bigger than what it really is at times. That's another thing when your brain kind of just isn't functioning the right way during times of high stress.
And as you mentioned, people get overwhelmed all the time, but it's just sort of how it's being approached. For someone feeling overwhelmed, though, what are some few simple, practical steps you could take today to try to manage that stress, no matter kind of what level you're at?
Yeah. I mean, most of us already know what they are. We just don't always apply them consistently. And sometimes you kind of sound like a broken record because it's like, what would your mom tell you to do? What would your grandma tell you to do? You know, and we say the same things, but you got to have good sleep. I mean, sleep is really important. Have good sleep hygiene. Make sure you're getting somewhere between 6.5 and 8.5 hours of sleep. When we get stressed, our brain actually sleeps differently. We have these sleep cycles, REM and non-REM, and you go into deep sleep and these restful sleeps. And what happens when you're stressed is those sleep cycles get all jumbled up, and so you don't actually get good restful sleep. And having good sleep hygiene, so what I mean by that is like not staying on your phone playing video games or looking at the most recent crisis that's in the news. You know, make sure you're kind of turning that stuff off, letting your brain kind of settle in and relax. Exercise is really good. So physical activity. So, you know, most of the time we're saying somewhere between 60 minutes at a minimum of cardiovascular activity per week. So 60 minutes could mean 10 minutes, 6 days a week, or you just want to work out one day a week at 6. And when I say workout, everybody always kind of like, oh my gosh, that means I got to go to the gym. You don't have to do that. It's literally just getting into what we call a cardiovascular zone. So start walking, walk a little bit faster. It's that spot where like it feels like it's a little hard to talk and move at the same time, but you're not totally out of breath. Just keep that up for 60 minutes a week. The other is caffeine. We as Americans consume an ungodly amount of caffeine. We actually know what the milligram dose is, where it actually starts to cause stress and anxiety for people. And
what is that dose? What is that?
Yeah. So 225 milligrams of caffeine. So I'll give you, if we have time, I'll give you a quick Jeopardy question for the day.
Okay.
So the way that they know this is that back in the 1950s, Navy fighter pilots were having to fly these 8 to 10 hour missions. And so they would give them caffeine so that they could stay focused and keep an airplane in the air and do the things that they need to do their job. But what happened is they were starting to give them more and more caffeine. They started to have panic attacks. Ooh. And so right around the 225 milligram limit, that threshold, is when fighter pilots, these super physically fit, you know, guys were having some panic attacks. And so that's where we know so an average cup of coffee you make in your house in the morning is about 80 milligrams of caffeine. When I say cup, okay, it's like 8 ounces or so. You go to Dunkin' Donuts and you get a medium coffee, it's about 200. So, you know, once you kind of have that second or third cup of coffee, it starts to actually put you in some not really good places with caffeine. And once you get over 400 milligrams, that's when it goes back to some of those heart issues and blood pressure and sleep and stomach issues. So we do actually know how much caffeine is not good for you. A little bit of caffeine is okay, but too much is not good.
Yeah. Are there other diet things that you should pay attention to as well when it comes to stress?
I mean, healthy eating, healthy lifestyle habits, eat in proportion, you know, talk about like go back to good sleep hygiene. A lot of us talk about I have heartburn, I have acid reflux. You're definitely not supposed to eat at nighttime. About 2 hours before bed, you should really have the last thing to eat because it causes all those stomach acids to kind of go back up into your throat, and it causes some people to wake up at nighttime. Stress can cause an increase in stomach acid. And so all those acidic things that we like to eat, you know, don't go drink a gallon of orange juice before you go to bed. Probably not a great idea to help with those stomach acids and things like that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Nicholas Batson of Crystal Run Healthcare. April is Stress Awareness Month, and if you're feeling overwhelmed, you're not alone, as the doctor says. Do you think are some other quick techniques that can help in the moment? Like, are there breathing or mindfulness exercises?
Yeah. One of the terms that we like to use is grounding. So grounding, and what we mean by that is using your five senses. So kind of like one of our senses is the things that we smell. And so sometimes people will do these grounding activities, these visualization things where I say, you know, what's going on right now? I want to connect my brain to my body, to the environment that I'm in. You know, is it light outside? Does it feel hot or cold in here? You know, one of the things I like to have my patients do is say, if you have socks on, can you feel the seam in the toes of your socks? And everybody's like, I don't know, I haven't thought of that. I'm like, well, you're so anxious, your brain's all over the place. These are the things that we don't think about. But that grounding starts to bring you back in. It lets you use those coping strategies, those resilience techniques. Meditation is great. A lot of people, when they think of meditation, they think of these like monks that are sitting in a temple for hours. You don't have to do that much. You only need about 2 minutes a day. That's it. 2 minutes a day of focused brain activity on something like meditation. And there are hundreds of apps out there. Like we used to have to like tell people, go to Barnes & Noble and find a book. Now I say, open your phone up, like Google it. You'll find it in 2 seconds. And so there's all these great meditations. So 2 minutes a day, that's all you have to do.
Right at your fingertips,
Yes, right at your fingertips. And the key to this is don't try to do them when you're stressed out. Try to do them when you're not quite as stressed out. It's kind of like a fire drill. The reason why we do practice fire drills is because when the fire happens, you don't want to freak out. Your brain doesn't want to go all over the place. And so if you can practice some of these techniques, the breathing techniques and grounding and meditation, when you do get stressed and when you do get overwhelmed, you can apply them and they act much more quickly than they would if you were like, oh, I've never tried this. I'm going to like try to breathe well. And you can't because you're full of caffeine and haven't slept and your boss at work's yelling at you and all the stressors are just compounding on there.
You know, when folks do get to a level where they're feeling just really stressed out, they may not want to talk to other folks about it. They may kind of clam up a little bit. But is seeking support a good coping strategy?
Yeah. Socialization and having, you know, I like to have this idea. A lot of times stress is in our body. It's internal. And so by seeking help, family, peers, coworkers that you trust, go to your physician, your doctor, your nurse practitioner, whoever you see for your healthcare and say, something's not right. I'm just kind of stressed. Most people are kind of surprised, like, oh, everybody's stressed. Well, everybody is stressed, but you don't have to be stressed all the time. And so when it starts to affect your health and when it starts to affect your just general quality of life, I mean, a lot of us know, like, something's just not right. Somebody tells you, your significant others be like, you're stressed all the time. Like, just chill. Whenever people start to repeatedly tell you, well, you just need to chill out, that may be kind of a sign that you're a little stressed out. You might need to get some help. But it's super important because even just the social aspect of saying, hey, maybe I don't know how to handle this and maybe somebody can help me with this and take some of this load off of me, super important to do those kind of things.
Maybe people can see a different perspective about the problem that you're talking about, too, that's stressing you out. Maybe they're seeing it differently, too.
I think in your previous life, you must have been a therapist. Because I'm hearing you using a lot of things that we talk about. No, look at, you know, how do you eat an elephant, right? Well, you eat it one bite at a time from different perspectives, right?
So
you're right. Yeah, giving you a different kind of way to look at it is a wonderful thing to have somebody to guide you through. And that's where sometimes a therapist or a licensed clinical social worker, a counselor. A lot of people at work have EAP programs that have these like really brief, you know, let me help you deal with some stress and give you some strategies and ideas. It's kind of like you get to put your toe in the water before you really commit. And so using some of those resources can be really good.
When should someone consider reaching out to a doctor or a mental health professional?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's when that physical thing starts to take over your day. It's when that mental part starts to take over your day. Some people ask, and I say, you know what, rule of thumb, if you're spending an hour a day being stressed out or physically dealing with something, that should be enough. Like, that should be enough. We shouldn't have to go through all that kind of stuff all day. No one needs to be miserable. We need to all enjoy what we're doing, have wonderful quality of life. And so if this is happening every day and you're not sleeping and you're not eating, you feel just unhealthy, your brain feels like it's not in the right place. And that's a lot of people say, like, I'm just not in a good headspace. That's the time to go seek some help.
Are you seeing differences in stress levels across age groups, like teens or older adults?
Yes, for both. I'm also a child and adolescent psychiatrist. So different school stressors, you know, social media stress, which, I mean, I won't date myself, but I'm an old millennial. And so, like, I'm like, I can't imagine, like, having to manage school and then go home and manage my online life. There is a different level of stress that we see in helping people stress it, turning it off, not being involved when someone's bullying you in a certain way. Yes, those are things that youth, then they're stressed that we're having to deal with them versus someone who may be a little bit older in their years. They may be having some physical things, some physical limitations, right? I can't move as much as I used to be able to move. I'm not able to do the physical things, even though my brain is sharp and clear and I can problem solve and teach you about nuclear physics or whatever people do. But they're like physically. And so that transition into later life where your physical body is not really able to keep up is another type of stress that's just generationally a little bit different. And then we have the in-between, right? They call the in-between generation, the sandwich kind of generations. And they're taking care of their kids and they're taking care of, you know, their older parents who are living longer and staying healthier into later age. And so we have different levels of stress and we have to approach them differently. Everybody's stress is different. Everybody needs a different strategy to deal with it.
Lots of good advice, lots of good understanding here, a little bit more about stress. But if there's one thing you want folks to take away from this conversation, just, you know, the general awareness of Stress Awareness Month, what would that be?
Yeah, you can prevent this. I mean, this is something that you can prevent. It's something that you can treat. We all deal with stress. We have to have a little bit of stress. It's the chronic stress that we need to take care of that's going to help us stay healthy, not just now, but also in the future, so that we can do all the things that we want to have a great, wonderful, high-quality life.
That's Dr. Nicholas Batson with Crystal Run Healthcare. More information at crystalrunhealthcare.com. Doctor, feeling less stressed already. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, joining me in studio now, someone who I probably cause some stress. It's Ronald Kelson.
Oh, I never feel stressed working here. No, never, ever, ever. Especially not during our spring fun drive.
It is 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. There's some practical advice there, though, from the doctor. You know, like just even things where you think, oh, wait, like, how am I approaching this? What am I thinking about this, like, maybe small problem and making it a bigger problem? Just, you know. Take it easy. Take a chill pill.
Yeah, it's really great that Radio Chatskill and lots of and our other local shows get to bring you these nuanced and these sources who are fairly balanced and know what they're talking about, experts to
right
help you
improve. Too.
Right in our community from Crystal Run. We had Elmville Regional Hospital on earlier this morning. We have a number of Optum Health as well. And these are the kinds of things that you can get only on Radio Catskill in our listening area. We provide you that local expertise to really help you make meaningful impact in your life. And one way to support that is by giving to our spring fund drive. You can give us a call, 845-482-4141, or donate online, WJFFradio.org.
And it's just, you know, we take time to talk about these things because it's important and you may not really think about it. I mean, you could see that it's, you know, April is Stress Awareness Month. But if you talk to a doctor who deals with this in your backyard about, you know, some practical things and you relate a little bit more as you're listening, that might help you. I hope it helps some folks.
Any time of year.
845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more Radio Chatskill after this.
Hey, We love Radio Catskill. It gives a lot of great programming.
I think we have a very split population, like most of the country, and getting two sides of a picture is really great.
Local news and interviews are very important.
It's more important than ever to have talented, smart people looking at the world and providing intellectual, well-reasoned coverage.
Your donation ensures Radio Catskill can maintain the level of integrity we bring to you every day. Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Call us also in the office, 845-482-4141. We love to say hi, and that's part of our fun drive, a chance to connect with you as well. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York could lose up to 14% of its workforce as a result of the federal government's mass deportation programs. That's according to a new report from the Institute on Immigration, Integration, Research, and Policy at the Rockefeller Institute of Government. The New York Public News Network's Mariam Ahmad spoke with author and senior fellow at the Rockefeller Institute of Government, Scott Fine, about the wide-ranging impacts of mass deportation on the state's revenue, tax revenue, industries, and immigrant communities.
New York State has been a magnet for immigrants in some measure as a result of Ellis Island and as they would say, chain migration. We number now among the fourth largest recipient of immigrants, and you could ask almost any elected official and they'd say that has resulted in our population increase and our employment, our workforce. In New York State, 20% of all construction workers are non-citizens and subject to deportation. In agriculture, it's more like 40 to 50%. Transportation, 20%. Manufacturing, 15%. And the number that would affect the most people is direct care services, services for the elderly, children, and human services in hospitals and the like. The consequence of the deportation of those people will do a variety of things. One, it will change, if you will, not the actual complexion, but the nature of our economy. It will increase on the average of family cost about $2,100, and it will increase inflation by about 3.1%. So a dramatic effect. And the concern is that we have no way of backfilling. Immigration has been responsible for about 40% of our population growth in the United States, and the Gallup poll suggests that it may be as large as 80% in future years. So we're not quite certain how, after a deportation, we will fill those positions.
When it comes to New York State, there are a number of resettlement programs that have, you know, boosted economies outside of New York City, which is where most of New York State's immigrant population lives. What can you tell me about the impact that those resettlement programs have and what the impact might be of these deportation campaigns as well?
Well, that is a very good question. And it's sort of a journey. New York, the federal government decides where immigrants should settle, and New York State has received about 6-7% of the immigrant population over the past decades. But of that number, 95% of the refugees were resettled in upstate New York. Now, there's hardly a schism between upstate and downstate, but downstate is often thought of as more liberal, and upstate there are pockets of conservatism, and there was a concern. You are going to parachute in tens of thousands of refugees from, as it turns out, 28 different nations. to a more conservative area. What were you thinking? Well, obviously, they were thinking quite well, because over the past 25 years, these communities have absorbed these immigrants, these refugees. And if you ask the public officials and the business leaders in Buffalo and Syracuse and Binghamton and Albany, the urban areas, and of course Utica, which is the haven, they would say, send us more immigrants. Buffalo had lost 50% of its population since the 1940s. Rochester, a similar, somewhat lesser number. Syracuse, also a similar number. And they've repopulated as a result. And it's not just adding people to live. It's safeguarding the schools, because they need students. It's generating revenue. It's building small businesses and creating communities. And some of those most outspoken with respect to the presidential mass deportation program are the elected officials from those communities.
You spoke a bit about the resettlement programs here in Albany and in the Capital Region. In your research and the data you've compiled, how have you seen the potential impacts of mass deportations reflected by the numbers?
The Capital Region would probably fare better than many other regions. For example, once you get to the more agrarian portions of our state, they're not relying upon government employees, if you will, to generate local taxes. 60-70% of their revenue is associated with agriculture. They're not quite certain what they are going to do. And in New York, that's a similar issue. New York, they don't have agriculture, but they rely upon their immigrant population to fill critical needs. And so far, the federal government has succeeded in deporting close to 2 million people nationwide.
I think one of the other questions I had primarily was also, you know, as you mentioned, there is more than just an economic impact on these from these deportation campaigns. What are your concerns about how this is impacting beyond just the economic factors? Mm-hmm.
Well, that too is a very good question. The fear in the immigrant community is that because the issue is not only one of undocumented immigrants, but non-citizens. So, for example, immigrants who have been here for 10 and 20 years, or who have children who are not, who are American citizens, the fear is that they will have to stay underground for some period of time. Now, on one hand, you'll say, well, so they can't go and shop. Well, that presents its own issues. But that also means that you don't go to the doctor's office, where there may be federal agents, or the hospital, where there are no federal agents. And schools, where these agents have stationed themselves, and that they perceive to be, or are told that that is their job, to intercept their children. So, in effect, we have taken our social system and we have forced a substantial portion, 10% of our social system, to go underground. And I can't even imagine, from their perspective, those who are subject to that, how you confront it. Do you leave? Some have chosen to leave. They said, we can't deal with this anymore. We can't safeguard our children. And others, we simply don't know about.
That was New York Public News Network's Miriam Ahmed speaking with Senior Fellow Scott Fine at the Rockefeller Institute of Government about his report from the Institute on New York possibly losing up to 14% of its workforce as a result of the federal government's mass deportation programs. Joining me in the studio, our reporter, Kimberly Izar, who's been covering immigration in our region. And yeah, this is an interesting report and the impact that these policies are having.
It is, Tim. And I'll say that we've been following, you know, immigration in the area for some time. There was an Orange County, warehouse being proposed in Chester just a few months ago. That has since been, they've moved on from that. But Orange County Jail has an existing agreement with ICE, and advocates have been rallying to end the agreement that the jail has. I'm talking to advocates later this week, and we'll be hearing more about that hopefully in the next few days.
Yeah, yesterday, a coalition of residents and community organizations held a rally opposing the contract between ICE and the Orange County Jail. According to organizers, there were over 130 attendees about that protesting that contract. So we'll stay on that story. In the meantime, you are also in the office picking up, covering the news.
We're doing all the things.
Impacts of immigration. You're also taking donations for our fund drive. Who did you hear from already?
So I spoke with Bill and Cindy from Calcoon, who just made a lovely donation. They're friends of the station, and they're really excited to support us during this time.
Bill and Cindy, thank you so much. Friends of ours, too. We appreciate that. That's a beautiful thing. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org is where you can call and donate and support us during our fund drive, just like Bill and Cindy in Calcoon and all the other folks who've donated. We're at 69% of our goal. We need to meet that by the end of the week. I think we're going to get there at hopefully sooner rather than later.
I think so, too.
Yeah. 845-482-4141. WJFFradio.org. We'll take a quick break and come back with local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
My name is Jasmine Garst, and I'm an immigration correspondent for NPR. Covering immigration right now is extremely challenging. A lot of the people I'm interviewing are hiding because they're too afraid to go outdoors. Something that I have really tried to focus on in my work is the humanity and the nuance and complexity of every human being, whether that is a 12-year-old girl trying to live her life in Minneapolis or a farmer in Florida. I think that we're at an inflection point in which we're really questioning our identity as a country, what we're okay with and what we're not. And that's something that I think is going to be a really big story this year. Your donation supports journalism that gets to the heart of the story. Please give today, and thank you.
Donate now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, it's Monday. The chance to check in with James B. Huntington, our local economist and author, keeping an eye on the economy for us. James B., happy Monday.
You too. Good morning, listeners. Good morning, Tim.
Well, what did we learn about inflation last week?
Well, the Fed's favorite inflation gauge, which is the personal consumption expenditures, went up 0.4% for the month and 2.8% from a year ago. The core measure was up the same 0.4% and 3% over what it was a year ago. Prices were goods. For goods were up 1.2% on an annual basis, and service prices were up 3% measured the same way. That's 3% even. So these are staying sort of high. They're not really going up, but they're just hanging out in their range. It's remarkable in a way with all the things that have gone on. They haven't changed one way or another, but there they are, and not much is going on.
Is the Iran war showing up in the inflation numbers?
Probably. It's had an effect that's offset other things to a real factor, but not a great deal, because I'm seeing the services is so much higher, and goods, which you would think would be made higher by the war, are not affected as much. So not very much. It's really just affecting energy prices.
What are we learning about the numbers that, you know, we get the numbers as a delay, right? So we're talking about the fourth quarter here. How did the U.S. economy change in the fourth quarter?
Yes, well, it's been an up and down year. The fourth quarter results said that our economy grew at an 0.5% annualized rate. Now, you compare that with some others, the other three pieces of 2025, it contracted. It went down 0.6% in the first quarter, but it went up 3.8% in the second quarter and 4.4% in the third. So overall, we have an annual rate of 2.1%, which is reasonable. It's decent. It's certainly nothing special, but it's nothing awful either. So that, too, the size of the economy, and this is all measured by gross domestic product, is not doing a great deal either, just hanging out.
Now, let's talk about how all of the economic news and inflation affect your wallet and your finances. Some folks can blame their bad finances on inflation, but is that really the case, or maybe some folks spending too much?
Well, this is a rather stern article by a commentator in Fox News, and he was saying that there's a narrative floating around right now that if inflation would cool off and if prices would finally come down, Americans would be back on solid financial footing. And he says, I don't buy it. Not at all. He says a lot of Americans are going broke. They're just spending too much. He says we've spent the last few years blaming inflation, corporations, interest rates, so-called greedy pricing, but we have to look at what's been happening otherwise. He said that he looked at multiple high-end restaurants, airports, attended concerts and live shows, and he saw that every one of them was full. Not half full, not struggling, but packed. That's not the behavior of a scared or worried consumer. That's the behavior of a consumer who's still very comfortable spending and really doesn't believe that they're going to hit hard times. So people are still, he says, booking vacations they can't really afford, eating out multiple times a week, buying clothes, gadgets, and experiences on impulse. They're running up credit card balances, which he described as the kind of debt that's like having saturated fat in your diet, where it's about the worst thing. It's certainly nothing bad as such to have, say, mortgage debt, but when you have credit card debt and you're paying 20% or more to keep that going just to cover the interest on that, that's a bad kind of debt to have. So he's talking about overspending, instant gratification, algorithm buying on social media, lack of budgeting, reliance on debt. So it's just, yeah, as this kind of thing goes, if you see yourself, if you're suspicious of yourself after hearing this reporting of a rant, more or less, from me, then think about if it's possible you need the things you do, or if you're really endangering yourself and making life more expensive by running up this kind of debt and such. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, then you're not. Mm-hmm. But have a peek at it. If you're struggling, just have a look at whether your spending really needs to be where it is now.
Maybe some spending discipline is needed for some folks. Yeah, I mean, there's some opinion there, but the facts are credit card debt is at an all-time high. And so there is a kind of imbalance there. Also, talking about some imbalances, this is an interesting article I saw the New York Times about blue-collar work plateauing because the options for young workers have narrowed. what alternative to white collar work might be plateauing, the blue collar jobs? Hello?
Yes. Well, this has been a piece of general knowledge for the last year or two or three, really, ever since the AI thing exploded out into the news about a little over 3 years ago. The idea that being that especially skilled trades, electricians, plumbers, and drywall people, and anything that requires a lot of skill that is not a white-collar situation, something that's usually part of construction and such things. That's been a story for a while, and it's been a good idea, really, certainly for new graduates and such to consider getting into these fields as they do. They pay very well, especially if you're with a union and you have the right kind of agreement, you've passed all their tests and whatever, and you have skill and competence with doing these things. You can make remarkable amounts of money without having to go to college, really. So what we have here is they're leveling off the number of jobs, the jobs in sectors that includes trades, such as manufacturing and construction. Unfortunately, those things are not broken out often, but they're down a total of 150,000 jobs available being advertised right now. So hiring rates are down considerably. They're at the pace of 2009, when the unemployment rate was 10%. We don't have nearly as many layoffs and such people losing jobs as we did then, but getting jobs is no easier, really, than it was when unemployment was twice what it is now. So watch out. These things, yeah, they're heading down somewhat the openings for these things, so it may be, some of it may be where if there's an open secret, a secret becomes open and everybody knows, it's possible they have more applicants and so on than they did before a few years ago, and now it's just catching up. Mm. So it's still a good area, it's still worth serious consideration, but it may be a bit harder to get into these fields than it was a year or so ago.
All right, the spring fund drive is squeezing our time a little bit, so I want to jump over to the numbers. What were the numbers on the stock market, oil, other numbers, and how did they change from last week?
Okay, yes, this is 1 week. Gold, $47.27 the ounce, up 29, stabilizing, but up. Silver, $74.37, up $1.11. The ratio between those two is 63.5 to 1. Looks good, even if silver is not at its peak, it's still not going down to the 40s or 50s or anything like that. So it's still hanging on, really. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 47,917, up just over 1,400 over the past week. Could go down today, but we're always dependent on what happens in the Gulf. NASDAQ, 22,903, that's down, up just over 1,000, doing the similar thing. Really good weeks for both. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 104.67, that's still down almost $5. It was under 100 for most of the past week before the latest antics out there took place. Bitcoin, 70,635, up a little over 1,000. Peaceful by its standards these days. British pound, 1.3420, up 1.7 cents, stronger, but it could just give it back. There's a lot of random fluctuation, or so it seems in these things. Euro, 1.1684, up about 1.3 cents, really the same story. Japanese 100 yen coin is still sleeping at 63%. So we could be poised for a big week, especially if the Gulf behaves itself. But it's one thing is that the artificial seeming Gulf flailing and changes and apparent mood swings or something swings aren't affecting the market as directly as much as it does. The market is tending more and more to say, yeah, well, how much are gold and silver and oil and the Dow really worth right now? They're not expecting anything, any continuity, which makes it hard for them to have huge effects. So there we are.
Well, James B. Huntington, our local economist and author, keeping an eye on the balancing ball there from the stock market to the job market. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Upper Delaware River, one of the region's most treasured natural resources and national resources, we know that. But like many places, it faces a persistent challenge, litter. We'll find out what folks are doing about it with Lori Ramey from the Upper Delaware Council next. This is Radio Chatskill.
It's Layla Faldin from NPR's Morning Edition. The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats. This aversion to truth has taken hold as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving reams of disinformation to fill the void. In public radio, we have a responsibility to counteract disinformation. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction. Having a reporter at the school board meeting, at City Hall, that is our resistance to the undermining of a free press. We resist by being there, by providing platforms for people to see themselves reflected and to see difference. We resist by building bridges and by holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, every year, volunteers across the River Valley come together to clean up roadways, riverbanks, and public spaces as part of the Upper Delaware Council's litter sweep. Now in its sixth year, the effort continues to grow, drawing hundreds of volunteers by a shared goal, keeping the Upper Delaware clean and healthy for everybody. Joining us now, Lori Ramey, Executive Director of the Upper Delaware Council. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Well, let's talk about the status of the sixth annual Upper Delaware Litter Sweep. We had Stephanie Driscoll on from your team to talk about it. And how's it going so far?
Right. Of course, we're almost in the middle of our Earth Month, April, and we decided a couple years ago to extend it for the entire month so that people would have a lot of flexibility in their planning of cleanups. So at this point, we've had a few take place, but we really have quite a few happening this weekend in particular. This tends to be a popular time because we're right before the legitimate Earth Day on April 22nd. So this weekend alone, we have five different cleanups. On Saturday, for example, the 18th, we have the town of Highland and Lumberland join forces for what tends to be the largest turnout that we have. Not that it's a contest, but sometimes people treat it as such. We also have the town of Delaware on the outskirts of the town doing a cleanup. And in the town of Fremont, the Roscoe Family Outdoor Club will be cleaning up. That's all Saturday. Then on Sunday, on the Pennsylvania side, we have cleanups in Damascus and Westfall townships that always are very popular, too. And then, of course, we have an entire schedule. There are weekdays involved. There are other weekends coming up. And we have a calendar posted on the homepage of our website at upperdelawarecouncil.org, where all of that information is listed, as well as the litter leaders that can be contacted if you're interested in joining as a volunteer.
And in Calicoon, they're doing a big event for Earth Day centered around the Calicoon Depot. Talk a little bit about what's going on the 25th.
That's right. That's actually the very opening event for the Calicoon Depot for their season. And they decided to celebrate Earth Day and all things sustainability and environmental stewardship. So this will be the following Saturday, April 25th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on the depot grounds. And the depot, if you're not familiar, is an 1896 train station. It was in service for many years with the Erie Railroad. Now it is owned by Central New York Railroad, but it's been leased to the local community to transform it into a visitor center for the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway and then a community hub. So it's very important to all of the groups involved, which is the Calicoon Business Association, the Calicoon Depot, Inc., which has formed a 501c3 to do this renovation, and the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway, that there are activities that appeal to everyone in all interests. So on April 25th, the Earth Day, from 10 to 4, rain or shine, will include a lot of activities that are geared toward anybody interested in local action and what they can do to help out the environment. But there will be performances by Farm Arts Collective. There will be two guided nature walks with Laura Silverman from the Outside Institute at 11 a.m. or 2 p.m. to take a little walk down River Road in Calicoon and see what sort of environmental diversity is there. And then as part of this day as well, we're doing a litter sweep throughout the hamlet of Calicoon, and that will be specifically from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., and all of the same amenities will be available to people with our amazing T-shirts this year, which is a unique design every year. And we provide all the supplies. We give you gloves, we give you the garbage bags and pickers so that you don't have to touch it with your hands if you prefer not to. All we need for that cleanup is to let me know in advance that you'll be there, and that way I can make sure I have the proper T-shirt size. I
want to make sure we get a chance to mention some of the auction about that original artwork. Jeff George Design and Salvage Company of Honesdale did the design, and you're going to have an auction of the artwork?
That's right. That's a first-time opportunity we have for people to actually take that framed artwork home with them. It's going to be an online auction, and we'll soon be publicizing the where and when you can participate in that. Watch for our social media and website.
And Radio Catskill is a proud media sponsor of the Litter Sweep once again this year, but you want to make sure we mention a couple of other Litter Sweep contributors.
Yeah, it's totally volunteer-driven and also supported by funding outside the UDC's operational funding. So Nadia Reich, who is the chairperson of the Sullivan County Legislature, has been extremely supportive of this event from the start. From her discretionary fund, she'll be donating $2,000 that she's pledged. And then we have donations from the Delaware River Basin Commission, as well as the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway Committee, of $500 each. And then we have individuals who have offered donations as well. And all of that, whatever we don't use to invest in supplies, will be seed money for next year's event.
And you guys have a new page on your website, upperdelawarecouncil.org/litter resources, some resources for folks. What are some of those
first
resources?
Yeah. Right. We decided that obviously we're in the business of picking up trash through this, but if we could prevent it from being there in the first place, it would obviously be the most beneficial for the land and the water so that no pollution migrates into it. So we've pulled together some resources which not only give tips about how to recycle and proper disposal, but also list the consequences for illegal dumping and not having vehicles covered with a tarp, for example, because there are some serious ramifications to breaking the law by littering.
That's Lori Ramey, Executive Director of the Upper Delaware Council. Get out there, help pick up some litter during Litter Sweep, or come to that Earth Day event in Calicoon, or just prevent some litter from getting out there. Lori, thank you for all you're doing here, not just for the Litter Sweep, but just the whole region. You guys are such a great steward of the Upper Delaware.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder, you can still donate on our webpage or call us at 845-482-4141. Donate to our spring fund drive and help us wrap it up. We have just about, $20,000 to go? We could do it quick. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. We can do it with your support. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Vintage House, selling vintage clothing, records, books, and toys from the past. A walk back in time on Main Street in Jeffersonville and at vintagehousejville.com. And from listeners like you.
My name is Danielle Kurtzleben, and I am a White House correspondent at NPR. I've covered a lot of elections. I have talked to countless voters. Trump and his administration and his allies are flooding the zone very effectively right now. I really like to say things plainly. I just want to give it to them straight. Support journalism that holds the powerful to account. Donate to this station today, and thank you.
Make your donation now at wjffradio.org.
This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, breezy, maybe a stray shower, I-70. Cloudy tonight, low 53. Warming up throughout the week, 74 tomorrow, 77 Wednesday, 82 on Thursday. We will kind of get back to more relatively spring-like temperatures Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in the 70s and mid-60s. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.